From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. The realignment of the California prison system has quickly and dramatically reduced the state's prison population. As more offenders are either serving their time in county jails or out on probation, the question most are asking is whether the emptying of state prisons is resulting in more crime. The nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California has published a series of reports that address that question. Our guests are the authors of those reports. Dr. Magnus Lofstrom, a senior fellow at the PPIC and an expert on public safety and realignment, and Brandon Martin, a research associate at PPIC specializing in criminal justice and corrections issues. We'll also hear from Modesto Police Chief Galen Carroll, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, Kings County DA Greg Strickland, and Fresno State Criminology Professor Emma Hughes. Realignment. Is more street time resulting in more street crime?
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from Paramount Agricultural Companies, growing healthy food for you and your family.
From the California Channel at the State Capitol, Valley PBS, and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. When realignment was passed in 2011, critics said it would result in a spike in crime. Were they right? Our guest is Dr. Magnus Lofstrom, a senior fellow at the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California and an expert on public safety and realignment. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you, Mark.
So let's start with a brief description of what is realignment.
So realignment was really the state's response to a federal court order mandate to reduce the prison population by more than 30,000 and addressing unconstitutionally poor prison conditions. The way that realignment addressed this was to shift responsibilities and funding from the state to the counties. It was intended to reduce reliance on incarceration and increased use of evidence-based practices. To do that, more specifically, what it did is it focuses on lower-level felons. These are your non-serious, non-sexual, non-violent offenders. And most of newly sentenced triple nons or lower-level felons will now serve their term in jail instead of state prison.
So the triple nons is, again, just be clear about that, it's non-serious,
non-violent,
non-sexual.
Non-sexual,
okay.
Right. And the other key part was parole violators. So you can no longer send back a parole violator to state prison. They are now sanctioned locally in the county.
And I think they call them frequent flyers. They keep coming back.
That's right. These were the churners of frequent flyers.
Yeah, one thing I want to explain to our audience is that people sometimes misunderstand, you know, prison and jail and parole and probation. And just to be very clear about it, when you talk about prisons and parole, that's state.
Right.
And when you talk about jails and probation, that's county. It's
right.
Very specific. Sometimes you kind of gloss over those words, but they really have different meanings.
That's right.
So what do the proponents tout as the advantages of realignment?
Well, besides not having to resort to releasing 30-some-odd thousand inmates early from state prison, cost saving was one big benefit of this. It was expected with the reduced reliance on incarceration that would lead to cost saving. And also the opportunity to reduce recidivism, reoffending amongst released offenders.
They thought they'd do better at the local level.
Exactly. The locals can do a better job. We had a high recidivism rate. About two-thirds of released offenders were back in state prison within
2/3.
Three years.
Wow. Okay, so what were the criticisms or concerns with realignment?
Well, the concerns were a number. Capacity was one, both at the county jails and probation. There were concerns as well about funding, so mm-hmm. both in terms of sufficient levels of fundings and also the stability of funding. And then, of course, with the reduced reliance on incarceration, the concern was there regarding public safety. The crime was going
to
help. Go
yeah. So they wanted to know, where's the money to do this, and,
right.
and are these people now out on the street going to cause more crime?
Right.
Okay. Proposition 30 plays a role in this. What was the role that Prop 30 played in realignment?
Prop 30 was very important because it provided a constitutional protection of the funding for realignment.
And it answered the money question.
Exactly. It does. And provides the stability. The counties now know that these money will come in. And in terms of making long-term investments, that's key. If you don't think that the money is going to be there next year, you're not going to make the long-term kind of investment decisions that are, I think, are necessary in order to be successful here.
So you had realignment, and one of the issues was they wanted to reduce state prison overcrowding because of these federal court decisions. What impact did realignment have on addressing that problem?
It had a big impact. It reduced the state prison population quite dramatically by about 27,000 in the first year alone. That's about a 17% drop. But we haven't seen any further reductions.
Can we put that in context? How many people were in a prison at that time, state prison?
The total prison population at that time was...
About 150,000 or so?
It was about 155,000 or so.
Yeah. I'm just trying to get an idea because so people can understand.
Right.
But a huge chunk.
It's a 17% drop. So the 27,000 in the first year alone is a 17% drop in the prison population. And it was, we haven't seen reductions since then. So all the decline in the prison population was the first year.
Wow. Okay. Off the cliff and then it kind of plateaued
exactly.
out.
It leveled out.
Okay. So what impact did it have on county jails? So you're now shifting these people,
exactly.
some of them, to county jail.
Well, county jail populations increased, not surprisingly. In the first year, if you focus on the first year, which is where you see most of the action here, it increased by about 9,000. And since then, we've seen an additional 2,000 increase.
So,
it
wasn't a one-to-one correlation. In other words, you didn't release someone from state prison and they automatically went to county jail. Actually, it was less than that.
It was much less than that. So we see that for every three fewer offenders being sent to state prison, the county jail population went up by one.
Oh, okay. So one to three ratio.
Yes.
Okay. So if we took a look at the total number of incarcerated in California, both in state prisons
right.
and county jails, note that distinction. What did it do in terms of incarceration rates?
So what we see here then is, so if you take those two numbers, I think is a good way to think about this. We see a reduction of 27,000 in the state prison population, an increase of 9,000 if we focus on that first year alone in the county jail population. So what it means is that there are about 18,000 offenders who are not incarcerated as a result of realignment. In terms of incarceration rates, it brought us down to the levels that we saw in the early 1990s.
So you're seeing those people, 18,000, doing street time as opposed to jail time.
That's right. They're not incarcerated.
Okay. What about the state prison population as a result of realignment? How did that change?
Well, I think, you know, one way to look at this is it intended to address the court order, the federal court order to bring down the prison population to 137.5% of its design capacity. It did bring it down quite dramatically, 27,000, as I said, in the first year, but we didn't reach that mandated target. We've added some capacity with in-state beds, community correctional facilities, and also through a new medical correctional facility as well. Mm-hmm. We're still 3,000 short.
Okay. We're now joined by Brandon Martin, a research associate with the PPIC specializing in criminal justice and corrections issues. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Thank you, Mark.
So, county governments took over three new responsibilities as a result of realignment. What were they?
Sure. First, county jails now house lower-level felons. These are the non-serious, non-violent, non-sexual
the
felons.
The triple nons.
The triple nons, as they're called, mm-hmm. yes. They used to spend their sentences in state prison. They're now held in county jail. Second, parole violators now spend that time in county jail. So previously on parole, you would spend the violation time in state prison, but now you also spend that in county jail instead. And third, county probation departments are now in charge of supervising lower-level felons that come out of state prison that previously would have gone on state parole. They're now on county probation.
Right, state parole versus county probation.
Yes.
We talked about that earlier. Okay, so realignment gave counties considerable discretion. What are some of the non-jail alternatives that counties can use to address this issue?
Yeah, counties were given great discretion in choosing the programming that they want. The state expanded eligibility for electronic monitoring, day reporting center, and work alternative programs. The state also created new tools, and one of those tools is called split sentencing. And so this allows a judge for certain felons when sentencing them to give them a split sentence. So a period of incarceration in county jail followed by a period of what we call mandatory supervision in the community under the control of county probation.
Yeah, so the question is, I mean, some of these methods sound like they're going to be less expensive, you know, electronic monitoring as opposed to being in jail or prison. The question is, are they as effective? But let's talk about county response to realignment. Have counties been consistent in their response to realignment?
So because of the discretion given to counties, we see variation across the state in responses. Mm-hmm. We don't have complete information on the differences in programming and the numbers in these programs, such as electronic monitoring, and in the use of that, but we do know that there are wide variations in the use of split sentencing. So Contra Costa and Stanislaus County use over 80% of the cases available get split sentences. That's compared to Alameda in Los Angeles, which have used it roughly less than 10% of the cases.
So wide variation. Okay.
Very wide variation.
You know, some counties are under court-imposed capacity caps.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering, what's been the main response to realignment in those counties?
So unfortunately, we don't have detailed information on the jail population management choices in those counties. But we do see after realignment that early releases are up in those counties, and the jail populations continue to rise in those counties.
So they're letting more people out?
Yes. So as they've filled up the jails, they're under court caps that require them to release once they reach a certain number.
So generally, have counties been able to adequately respond to realignment?
Counties are doing the best they can with the funding and programming available. But once again, we have seen that early releases are up since realignment.
So there are some counties that are now that weren't operating at 100% capacity now are operating.
Yes. So even before realignment, the statewide jail system operated at about 90% of capacity, and now we're at roughly 110% of capacity.
Okay, more than that. Okay. So what's happening to county jails then to make room for these three non-felony offenders who are no longer in state prison? How are they?
So we don't know the exact choices of the counties, whether they're making sure they keep them in jail versus individuals that might have misdemeanors. But what we do see is that early releases are up. We hope that if they're using earlier releases, that they're using a valid risk-based model to release people.
Yes, and so, we would hope so.
And so you would hopefully see misdemeanors being released first versus more serious offenses like triple nons.
So what factors might affect a county's realignment strategy?
So setting aside sort of the previous choices and just looking post-realignment, we think that both the physical and staffing capacities of the counties in the jails and also probation are huge factors. If you don't have room in your jail to do programming, if you don't have space for it, you're unable to do that programming.
What about politics?
So politics, that varies from county to county, but you do see choices in the incarceration rates before realignment that have also continued.
I mean, it's kind of, you know, in politics, you can have this tough on crime strategy,
yep,
or you can have more of a reentry strategy. Are you seeing that play out at the county level?
I mean, there are wide variation. You know, San Francisco beforehand had programming already in place, and they've used their money to expand that programming. Other counties have chosen to open, close wings of their jails with that money and sort of reopen them and house as many people as they can.
So are you seeing jail capacity challenges increasing or decreasing over time? And are things going to get worse before they get better?
So since the start of realignment, we've seen the jail population increase monthly. And we believe that that will continue to happen in the short term, that jail population will go up. The state is investing $2.2 billion in new county jail construction. And so our report shows that by 2020, in a lot of these counties that have capacity issues, there will be some relief. But you have to remember that if you look long term out to 2040, the state's population growth will affect several counties, especially in the Central Valley.
Okay, well, I want to thank Brandon Martin for joining us. We're rejoined by the PPIC's Dr. Magnus Lofstrom, a co-author of several reports on crime and realignment. So what has been the general crime trends in California over the last few years? What have you seen?
Well, we've seen a long-term decline in crime rates in California, and specifically if we look at violent crime, it's been coming down since the early 1990s. Property crime rates have been coming down since the 1980s, early 1980s. So as a result, and it's pretty consistent. It's been some years where it's been coming up, but long-term decline. And as a result, now in recent years, we are at levels that we haven't seen since the 1960s.
Really? Wow. So it's going to be going down. You know, normally you expect, like in a recession, maybe crime rates are going to go up, but you've generally seen a downward trend.
Well, they do. I think it's, you know, they, in every year there are changes, but, and from a long-term perspective, we've been on a very serious and steep decline in crime rates in California and the nation as a whole.
So if we're looking at counties, let's break it down from state to county level. Are there differences in crime rates? I assume there are among counties. And does it matter if we're talking about violent crime or property crime?
Well, there are big differences in crime rates across the counties. And we see the lowest crime rates are generally found in our small and rural counties, as well as our Southern California coastal counties like Ventura, San Diego, and Orange County. The highest crime rates in general are really in the relatively poor San Joaquin, Central Valley, but also in San Francisco. San Francisco has some of the highest property crime rates as well as robbery rates.
Interesting. Well, so we were talking earlier about this 18,000 person gap between who has been in prison prior to realignment and who ended up in county jail. So many of these triple nons, as you referred to earlier, these offenders are doing probation, i.e. street time, instead of jail time. So what effect, if any, has this increase in street time because of realignment had on crime in California?
Well, I think it's fair to say that this is really the main concern with realignment, the additional offenders on the street as a result of the reform. And so in a report that we released in December of last year, we looked specifically at the effect of that. And we looked at the changes in incarceration rates and the crime rates across the counties to see if they were correlated. And more specifically, we looked at if there was any evidence that as a county saw more offenders on the street, whether crime rates went up. And generally speaking, we found that it really had a very limited and modest effect on crime.
So even if you had more people doing street time, you didn't see an increase necessarily in crime.
We saw, so we broke it down by violent and property crime. So if you start by looking at violent crime, we found no evidence that violent crime went up as a result of realignment and the additional offenders on the street. Counties that saw more offenders on the street as a result of realignment saw no more violent crime. Than those counties that saw less.
Okay, now let's talk about property crimes, a little different. What impact has it had on property crimes, and any specific types of property crimes more affected than others?
Right. So for property crimes, we do find that realignment had an impact. We found that property crime and especially auto theft rates went up as a result of realignment. And we estimate that the auto theft rate went up by about 65 per 100,000 residents. It's about 24,000 auto thefts in that first year of realignment alone. But just to put that in perspective, we had a declining trend in auto thefts before this. It brought us back to the rates that we've seen as recently as 2009.
So it's still relatively low is what you're saying, but it did trend up.
And from a time perspective, it's low, but California has the nation's highest auto theft rate.
We love our cars in California, don't we? Okay. So you also note in your report, however, that many factors contribute to crime trends. So how do we know if realignment is or is not the cause of these trends?
Right. So there are a number of things that could affect this, and it's a very difficult question to answer. And we think that we did a very careful analysis where we made sure that we addressed fundamental things that could affect the relationship between realignment and crime rates. We took into account county differences in terms of their ability, capacity that existed before realignment. Mm-hmm. We looked at underlying trends at the county level that could have been in place and could then have led to these kind of results, controlled for all that in our statistical methods, the economy, law
enforcement. So you tried to cover everything, and what did you
find? We covered everything, but we also took a step back and we looked at other states. We compared California to other states, and the idea here that, well, if realignment is really behind anything that we see in California, we ought to stand out, because no other state passed a reform of this magnitude at that particular point in time.
And you didn't find...
So what we did, so we took, we compared California's crime trends to comparison states that had very similar trends prior to realignment to California. And what we find is that violent crime rate trends stayed the same as the comparison states. Property crime started to diverge in 2011, and in 2012 there was a noticeable
gap. And specifically within property crimes, auto thefts.
Auto theft, exactly. So what we find in the state comparison is exactly what you see in the county level.
We've only got about 30 seconds left in this segment. I want to ask you, though, state prisons are still about 3,000 over the federal cap for capacity. And the capacity is 137.5% of design capacity. In other words, we'll allow you to go beyond 100%, but beyond 137.5%, that's too much according to the federal courts. So in your judgment, if they now use realignment or they remove people from state prison to lower that number to the 137% that the federal courts want, what is that going to do to crime rates?
Well, I think it's difficult to say exactly what it's going to do, because it's going to depend on who is actually affected by it, who who is it who's not going to be incarcerated as a result of further changes? So that's difficult to say because of that. But I think it's important that we keep in mind that the 3,000 or so that we need to bring it down, that's a small fraction of what we saw with realignment, and it had a modest and limited impact.
Right. Okay. Although controversial, crime prevention can be put in the context of a cost-benefit analysis. In short, what is the most cost-effective way to address crime? We're talking to the PPIC's Dr. Magnus Lofstrom. So let's start with a basic question. Is incarceration an effective crime control or public safety strategy?
Well, the crime preventive effectiveness of incarceration really depends on your reliance on it. Like so many other things, you know, policy tools and strategies, if you use it too much, it might not be particularly effective. And if we look at research that addressed the crime preventive effect of incarceration in the 1970s, when we had very low incarceration rates, similar to what they are in Europe today, maybe 1/6 of what we see today, that research finds broad crime preventive effects. It prevented both violent and property crime.
But what you're saying, though, there is kind of a law of diminishing returns, though, isn't
it? That's right. That's exactly what's going on here, because as we fast forward and we're increasing our incarceration rates, we are changing and adding offenders and the length of terms that they serve in prisons. And when we look at the research that is looking at incarceration rates at the level that we are at now, finds a much lower crime preventive effect of incarceration, okay, and that it's not a very cost-effective way of preventing crime.
Okay. So let's focus on property crimes for a second here, and specifically auto thefts, which you said appear to be on the rise as a result of realignment. That's what the statistics show. What's the most cost-effective way to deal with property crimes generally and auto thefts in particular?
Well, if you know, our research actually gives us some very useful information when it comes to the, you know, the crime preventive effect and the cost benefits of incarceration. We estimate that for each offender who's being incarcerated at the incarceration rates we were at the time of the realignment, that it prevents about 1.2 property crimes, specifically auto thefts. Okay. So that's for each year of prison incarceration, it prevents 1.2 auto thefts.
And let's give it a specific number. So the average cost of incarcerating someone in state prison is a little over $51,000.
Right.
And the average property crime or auto theft is, I think I read in your report, something around the range of $11,000, $12,000.
It adds. So for these 1.2, the benefit that we receive from locking someone up for 1 year is $12,000 worth of crime prevention.
And it's costing us $51,000 in putting them in prison.
For additional dollar that we spend on incarceration at these levels, we get about 23 cents back in crime prevention.
Okay, let's talk about violent crime. It's a little more difficult subject, but
right.
What does your research tell you about whether incarceration is a cost-effective strategy to reduce violent crime?
Well, so again, when we look at incarceration rates where we're at, we don't find any evidence that incarceration actually prevents violent crime. So instead, if violent crime is what we would like to decrease, and I think most people are interested in that specifically, we need to look for alternatives. Policing is one much more effective strategy. If we do the same kind of calculation for adding an additional law enforcement officer, the crime preventive savings that we get for that, for a dollar spent on that, is $1.60.
So, but let me go back to violent crimes for a second. So I think I read in your report that, I think you cited a RAND study that said that the average cost of a robbery is $70,641. It's pretty specific.
Right.
And again, incarceration cost is about $51,000, $52,000 to keep someone in prison. So why isn't that cost effective?
Well, we don't find that robberies really, that incarceration prevents robberies at the incarceration rates where we are at right now. So with adding an offender to state prison at the levels we're at now, you're not preventing robberies.
Okay.
You are preventing auto thefts. But violent crime, if that's the concern, we need to look for alternative strategies.
So in terms of deterrent effect of incarceration, you're saying not so much when it comes to violent crime?
There is. There's very little evidence that incarceration has a big deterrent effect. The main effect of incarceration in terms of crime prevention is really incapacitation. That is taking an offender off the street.
Okay. So let me, you get to solve the problem now in about a minute. That's okay. So what does your research suggest is the most cost-effective crime control strategy? You mentioned police.
Right.
What else?
Well, I think it's what we need to think about here is that we don't want to just, you know, put all the eggs in one basket here. We want to look at the and find the right mix of crime preventive strategies. And in doing so, we also need to figure out and think about the timing of the effects. So when we channel these savings from reduced incarceration, we have offenders on the street. We need to address that right away. Increased policing is one effective way of deterring that kind of situation happening. Further down the road, you want to think about evidence-based practices that will reduce reoffending, but that will take some time before most of that will actually be noticeable. But we also need to have a long-term perspective on this as well. So we would like to see strategies that actually addresses and prevents at-risk youth from entering the criminal justice system. So now we're looking at dropout prevention, you know, other kind of strategies to improve educational outcomes among at-risk youth. In general, I think what we need to think of is finding the right mix of crime preventive strategies.
You've got short and long-term strategies. Well, I want to thank our guests from the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, Dr. Magnus Lofstrom and Brandon Martin, for joining us.
Up next, what impact has realignment had on crime in the San Joaquin Valley? We'll talk to Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, Modesto Police Chief Galen Carroll, Kings County DA Greg Strickland, and California State University Professor Emma Hughes.
From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Mattie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We've talked about statewide crime statistics post-realignment, but what about here in the San Joaquin Valley? We'll now turn to some folks who have a Valley perspective on the issue. They are Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer. Welcome, Chief Dyer.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Modesto Police Chief Galen Carroll. Welcome, Chief Carroll.
Thank you.
Kings County DA Greg Strickland. Welcome, DA Strickland.
Thank you very much.
And Fresno State Criminology Professor Emma Hughes. Welcome, Professor Hughes.
Thank you.
So let's start with you, Chief Dyer. Before we talk specifics, I wanted to get your general thoughts on realignment. What's been the upside and what's been the downside?
Well, I don't know if there's been an upside to realignment, at least from the law enforcement perspective, because it has led to some early releases in our jail and overburdened local law enforcement. But I can tell you that even with that burden, we've been able to meet that challenge. And so I haven't seen the upside yet, at least for local law enforcement. I know the upside is for California prisons and being able to reduce the prison population and avoid some of the litigation that they were involved in. But for local law enforcement, I don't believe that there has been a benefit at this point.
So, Modesto, Chief Carroll, any upside at the local level with realignment?
Hey, you know, I think the only upside, and I actually agree with Chief Dyer, but the only upside would be having some more local control when it comes to providing some of the services that may prevent people from continuing to commit crimes. And that may come into effect later on, further down the line. But the problem is there wasn't a lot of planning and ensuring that the local entities were up and ready to handle that load or the level of inmates that were being brought back under local control. So it's kind of like building a freeway and declaring it open without paving it or leveling it or grading it, and now we're going back and trying to do that.
Yeah, I think about the intro to Law and Order and where they divide, you know, the law and the order. And so I'm going to talk to Kings County DA Greg Strickland, who's got the prosecutorial aspect of this. Do you see any upside to realignment?
The only upside was that Governor Brown was under a federal order to decrease the population in the state prisons. But other than that, I ditto what the police chiefs have been saying. The crime rate in Kings County on theft has gone through the roof. We're having agricultural crime is increasing. About a week ago, we had a business district that had seven businesses broken into. And, you know, with this new law that passed that basically making a lot of felonies, misdemeanors, just adding to the problem. And theft is theft, and I can't see where we're letting the thieves off and in the business, and everybody else is paying for it.
Professor Hughes, what do you see in terms of realignment? Has it? What's been the upside? What's been the downside from your perspective?
Well, for me, I would say the upside, and I'm coming at it from a slightly different perspective, from the corrections perspective, is that there's been increased emphasis on developing innovative community-based programs and using evidence-based practices to examine what can reduce reoffending for offenders being supervised in the community. So that, for me, I would say is the upside. The downside, I would say, is that the low-level felons who would originally have gone to prison who now go to jail sometimes spend many years in jail. Jails were not designed for long-term stay. They don't have the same kind of resources in terms of rehabilitation programs. And the individuals coming out from those kinds of sentences are not supervised in the community post-release. So that, for me, is the biggest downside.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, a layperson looking at this really glosses over the term prison and jail, thinking they mean the same thing, and they are quite different. Prisons results are from or discuss state issues, state prisons, and jails are county jails. And so jails were not designed for these longer holds that they're now seeing. But I want to ask you, Chief Dyer, you know, in Fresno, what were you seeing in terms of crime trends prior to realignment, and what has happened since realignment? I mean, have you seen a shift in the crime statistics, the crime rates?
No, I honestly have not seen a difference in Fresno. For example, violent crime has been down four consecutive years, 2011, 4%, followed by 6%, followed by 7% this year. We're down by just under 6%. And property crimes, last year we were down 12%. The year before we were up, and in 2011 we were up. So I haven't seen the numbers, but one of the things that we have to keep in mind is whether or not we're dealing with reportable crimes versus crime statistics. Because what I have found, at least in Fresno, is as a result of us downsizing our department, not getting the level of responsiveness, shifting reporting over to a computer-based system, self-reporting on the web, I don't believe that we have captured all of the crimes that were being committed over the last few years. Has nothing to do with realignment as much as not having the resources available to field those calls. So, but violent crime continues to be down, and I want to echo what was just previously said. The real challenge for us right now is not realignment. It is Proposition 47, because that's what we need to focus on. That's what's most recent, and that is driving our crime numbers up for the first time in many years, and I mean dramatically.
And summarize Prop 47 then for our listeners.
47 was enacted in November by a vote of the people, overwhelming vote of the people, that made possession of drugs, whether heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, made them misdemeanors. And that was a very effective tool that we had, was to be able to arrest those individuals for felonies. They would then choose, oftentimes in lieu of incarceration, drug treatment, which allowed them to get off their drug habit. The people that are the ones we were arresting were the people that are out there committing burglaries and auto theft and some other violent crimes, and those are the crimes that we are seeing on the rise. And I've only seen those numbers rise over the last 30 days or so.
You know, it's interesting. So you're seeing the reduction in crime statistics is really, your concern is that maybe it's less reporting more than the positive effect of realignment. I'm wondering if Modesto Chief Carroll has the same view. Have you seen a change in it?
Well, it actually has changed quite a bit for us, because crime was actually dropping in 2009, 2010. And even the first part of 2011, and realignment was started in October 2011, we had a 22% increase in crime in 2012. And we've been fighting for the last 2 years to try and bring that back down. But our violent crime rate in 2012 was up 17%, and in 2013 it was up 9.9%. And it's probably going to be up again this year. So we're having an impact on some of the property crimes, but our violent crime rate, driven by aggravated assaults, is going through the roof.
That's really interesting, because the PPIC, the Public Policy Institute of California, in their studies have found just the reverse, that they're saying that realignment's really had no real effect on violent crime, but some effect on property crime, and particularly motor vehicle theft. I want to ask Kings County DA Strickland, you were talking about property crime, you're seeing an increase in that, particularly in agriculture. What's been your experience in Kings County?
Well, we're seeing property crime go up, and we're seeing a lot of agricultural crime
of taking the gas and metals and those kind of things, and with the inability to house some of these people because the theft is considered a low priority in the jails and the lack of jail capacity in Kings County, they're getting released, and we're seeing 6 or 7 cases on the same individual, you know, with a year's time, so they're just going through the door. It's not the sheriff's fault. The order came down. They have to put him in the jail rather than send him to prison, and so he has no choice but to keep the violent people and let the theft go.
Yeah. Fresno Police Chief Dyer, you know, the PPIC says, listen, we're not seeing any real effect on violent crime as a result of realignment. They are seeing some effect with property crime, particularly motor vehicle theft. Is that what you're experiencing in Fresno?
We're not seeing the increase in auto theft, and it's, you know, I think it's so important that we not paint every county within California with the same broad brush, because everyone faces a uniqueness within their county and jurisdiction. Some have bed space, some do not. It really matters. It boils down to whether you're talking about realignment or Proposition 47, whether or not there are consequences. And we have seen increases in auto theft, dramatic increases, when we were not able to keep people in jail. And we took the steps to actually lease jail beds from the sheriff so that we could have control over who stays in and who is released. When we started doing that, and when our focus became more of a singleness of purpose on the career criminal auto thief, that's when we started to have dramatic reductions. And I will tell you, auto theft is still down this year in our city, 26%.
Yeah, I think you're an anomaly if compared to a lot of cities in California where you're seeing actually auto theft's going down in Fresno.
Yeah, well, we know that there's a small percentage of the auto thieves that are responsible for the vast majority of car thefts. And so we've tried to focus on them and make sure that they are the ones getting into the system and staying in the system. And unfortunately, if you don't have bed space, we were arresting the same individuals over and over 10, 12 times in a 6-month period. And when that happens, you're not going to win the war on crime. And so that's why I say it really doesn't matter whether it's Prop 47 or realignment. You got to have consequences. They have to be immediate, and you have to target the right offenders.
Well, what about the issue of more street time as opposed to jail time? You know, under realignment, parole violators and those three nons, those non-serious, non-violent, non-sexual felony offenders are less likely to spend time behind bars or under supervision. You know, they're doing their stuff, you know, on probation. What do you think about that, Chief Dyer? Is that an effective crime control strategy, or is it putting the public at risk?
Well, I think it's based on an individual, but I can tell you that when people are in jail, and they are career criminals, that they are not committing crimes, and our crime rates go down and people aren't being victimized. When you put those people out on the street and you have them under supervision, but not under a constant watch, there's a likelihood that they're going to be involved in criminality because they're addicted to some type of drug and they have to support that habit. And that's what we see. And, you know, I am a firm believer in post-release supervision, and I'm a firm believer that you have to have some type of services provided to those individuals and ongoing drug testing. But the reality is some of these individuals just have to be incarcerated. They have to be locked up because that's the only way we're going to keep them from committing crime.
Professor Hughes, I want to let you weigh in on this a little bit. What do you think about this issue of some of these folks, these three nons that they're called, spending more time on the street time under probation as opposed to jail time? Is that an effective crime control strategy?
Well, it probably depends really what is meant by street time. So, for example, if someone was sentenced to serve the time for their felony conviction in the jail, but they're released early because of overcrowding pressures, and then they have no supervision and they're just out on their own, that is kind of street time where they're on their own and who knows what will happen. However, if it's street time where they're under proper probation supervision, there might be electronic monitoring, for example, there could be regular drug testing, there could also be treatment programs, substance abuse programs, mental health care, things of that sort. You know, some of these programs have proven to be very effective around the country in reducing reoffending, and can sometimes do so much more effectively than just incarceration. So it really depends on what that street time consists of and how it came about in the first place.
Okay. Well, Kings County DA Strickland, I want to ask you this. You know, the state prisons still have a problem. There are at least 3,000 over capacity, according to the federal court order. In your judgment, will further reductions in the state prison population increase crime if they release these, you know, or try to figure a way to get rid of these last 3,000?
Well, if they're releasing criminals, they're going to continue to do what they're good at, and that's unfortunately committing crimes. And what we need to realize that we need to be aware that victimization is what's happening under the realignment. Even though it was forced, by federal judges, victimization is increasing. And the more career criminals you release, you're not going to be able to send them through rehabilitation. You're going to have to increase supervision if you're going to release them to the state. And then to do that, you need to have the facilities and the money and the personnel to do it. And if you're not going to supervise them, they're going to continue to commit crimes. And the bottom line is career criminals, you need to put them back in prison. And where they can handle those kind of individuals that they're basically institutionalized, they're never going to turn their lives around.
Yeah. So Modesto Police Chief Carroll, let me ask you this. So the state then defers these additional 3,000 people essentially to the counties, either through jails or probation. Is that a good idea?
No. I think one of the things we forget, and when I say we, I mean the public in general, is a lot of the, at least in my opinion, big drops in crime we had over the last couple of decades. We've forgotten why, in my opinion, those drops happened, and that was because we were taking the career criminals off the street, and we were making sure that they weren't able to victimize people around them. These are some folks, they need supervision, and they need to have accountability if they fail to change. The problem is, I don't think, at least in our county, we don't have the bed space, we don't have the capacity, so there isn't going to be the accountability that's needed to actually force someone to change the lifestyle they've chosen.
Okay. Well, up next, is realignment resulting in new crime control strategies in the Valley? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. The criminal justice system has undergone a significant change as a result of realignment, with more non-serious, non-violent felons spending time in county jails or doing street time on probation rather than in state prisons. What crime control strategies seem to be making a difference in keeping Valley communities safe in this post-realignment world? We're talking with Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, Modesto Police Chief Galen Carroll, Kings County DA Greg Strickland, and Fresno State Criminology Professor Emma Hughes. So, Modesto Chief Carroll, let me start with you first. Are there any crime control strategies that are either being emphasized or introduced in Modesto in this new post-realignment environment?
Two things. One is during our last cuts, which we lost about 28% of our force during the last economic downturn, but we also lost all the crime analysts. So we brought back three crime analysts to help point the officers in the direction of who is actually committing the most crimes so we can focus on them. But we also implemented predictive policing in January of 2014.
What is that?
It's a software program. It takes 10 years worth of your crime data, and then it updates it daily, and it spits through some mathematical algorithm that's done by someone way smarter than I am, and it gives a 500-square-foot box where it believes the next crime is going to occur for each shift. So each shift gets a different boxes, and instead of sending officers out to patrol a whole beat during their free time, we'll tell them, hey, you need to spend your time in this box, or we'll spend overtime and put officers doing bread pull operations in those boxes to try and prevent some of the crime up front.
Very, very interesting. Chief Dyer, anything that you're seeing happening now that's being emphasized or introduced as a result of realignment?
Well, our focus has been prior to realignment and continues to be on timely and accurate crime data that allows us to develop strategies and deploy our resources where they need to be.
during the times when we believe crimes are most likely to occur. We have a predictive policing model as well and software for that, and we have a what we call a crime view system in place. But the other strategy, I think we've taken our eye off the ball a little bit in law enforcement over the last 10 or 15 years, is we've been so focused on crime data that we've lost sight of the community. And we have made it a point to get our officers re-engaged in the community, not just some of our programs, but our officers in the field, knocking on doors, making contacts, trying to make sure that the community understands that this is a partnership. We're not the ones there to be an occupying force in their neighborhoods. We police with their permission. And with that, we want to gain their trust so that they will help us to be better eyes and ears. And we do that through a number of ways, but certainly our social media that we utilize for what we used to call Neighborhood Watch. It's still Neighborhood Watch, but we do it more so through social media, and that neighbors are watching out for each other. So I really believe it's important in law enforcement that we don't just adopt one strategy. Mm-hmm. That we're multifaceted, but number one, we have to engage the community at all levels in every strategy.
You know, a lot of this relies on more police officers. I mean, it's a labor-intensive job. One of the things that the PPIC research seems to show is that increased policing is a much more effective crime control strategy than incarceration. So I'll start with you, Chief Dyer. I mean, what levels of policing do you think are necessary to maintain a safe community?
Well, I think that's dependent upon the community. If you have a community that is like Fresno, that has high ratios of gang members and a methamphetamine problem, and I know in Modesto it's very similar.
Absolutely.
So the valley towns are very similar in this, in that we have high concentrations of gangs. We have a lot of people utilizing methamphetamine, and so you're going to need a higher number of officers. Unfortunately, when you look at many of the East Coast cities, they're at 4 officers per 1,000. In Fresno, we're at 1.4 officers per 1,000. So we're not able to do the same things that others do in other jurisdictions. But, you know, the old saying that cops count, police matters, I think PPIC proved that in their study. And police officers are not an expense. They are an investment in a community. If you have a safe community, you're going to attract business. You're going to retain business. And with that, you're going to increase your sales tax and the revenue for the city coffers. That is what's important. We have to be seen as an investment. And unfortunately, what's happening across the country right now, not only are police officers seen as an expense, but they're almost seen as a necessary evil. When you look at some of the civil unrest that's occurring, and we've got to change that. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful we will, but I do know we need to add more police officers in our cities if we're going to get ahead and stay ahead.
Let me ask Modesto Chief Carroll kind of a follow-up on that question, on that point that Chief Dyer is making, and that is this idea that hiring more police officers is an investment versus a cost. It's still going to cost money. It's got to come out of the city budget. I mean, what are the costs for adding a police officer, and where is that money going to come from?
Well, police officers are expensive when you put together the benefits and the pay and everything else. And I think an officer fully loaded is about $110,000 or $120,000 a year, something like that. The costs are being borne by the cities, and that's one of the issues that we have in the Central Valley. Is I believe there's a disparate impact on the poorer, more agricultural-based counties, because we get less in property taxes back than what mm-hmm. we're sending, far less. And so this whole shift from the state of incarceration to more policing and shifting it back to the local governments doesn't include the funds that could help those local governments actually police their cities. Like I mentioned before, Modesto, we had a 28% reduction in the number of officers we have. And we're at about the same level of one per 1,000 citizens, and that's if we're fully staffed. I think I have probably 0.88 officers per 1,000 right now trying to police the city. So, you know, just even getting back to half the level that we had in 2008 would help. But it is an investment, and I don't know that our city could pay for that right now. Yep. I don't know where the funds come from.
You know, $110,000 per officer is expensive when you include pay and benefits and everything else. But let me ask Kings County DA Strickland. you know, because of the cost or investment, however you want to describe it, for increased police staffing, are communities like Kings County looking for other less expensive ways to deal with crime? For example, use of technology, cameras, drones, things of that nature. How do you feel? Are they doing that? And if they are, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think Kings County is increasing their computers and technology and sharing of information, but that does make the system more efficient. But there is no substitute what I call boots on the ground. If you have a police officer on the corner, you're preventing crime, and if you have less police officers, there's the ability of the individuals to notice what's going on and take advantage of the lack of police officers. So you can put cameras in and you can put all that in, but you still need boots on the ground. You still need that interaction with the community. And in Kings County, we're working on that, but the money is tight and the budgets aren't there because we have to expand the jail. There's not the personnel to do the supervision. So you do have that will cause an increase in crime, in which we're seeing.
Yeah, Professor Hughes, Fresno State Professor Emma Hughes, let me ask you this. Let's focus a little bit on longer-term strategies, things like early childhood programs and programs targeted at high-risk youth. To what extent do you think we should be investing in those kinds of programs?
Well, I think these are very important programs to be looking at. There's been a lot of research done on these kinds of programs, and some very positive results have come out of these studies showing that they can be helpful in reducing crime in the future. At the same time, other kinds of programs that can be invested in the community would be mental health programs, drug treatment programs, all of those kinds of things that can potentially prevent crime in the future and lead to long-term solutions rather than just kind of putting a Band-Aid on the problem and sort of reacting rather than being proactive in tackling these root causes.
Okay, well, I want to thank our guests, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, Modesto Police Chief Galen Carroll, Kings County DA Greg Strickland, and Fresno State Criminology Professor Emma Hughes for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Matty Daily, by just logging on to our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for the Matty Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.